What's Cooking in Kentucky? Today on UK Perspectives. I'm Tom Goodell. The latest book from University Press of Kentucky brings handwritten recipes from the past to life. It's The Historic Kentucky Kitchen. And with us today is co-author Deirdre Skaggs. Welcome to UK Perspectives, Deirdre.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to take all these old recipes and put them together into one book?
That's a tough question because I think it was sort of a crazy thought in the beginning. Mostly it was just from stumbling across handwritten recipes in special collections and just thinking about how fascinating it would be to take something like that and literally bring it to life and have it be something that, you know, I could try and other people could try as well.
So you say you found these in special collections. Were they, what, tucked into a file folder with something else? Is that how you came across them?
Well, Andrew McGraw, my co-author, he was processing the English family papers. And among those papers are the Logan English records. He was a folk singer, poet. And within those folders, yes, there were handwritten recipes. And Andrew had a question about how to process the materials, and, you know, through the course of that conversation, we started talking about that handwritten recipe that we found, and again, how amazing it would be to try it and taste it today.
Looking over the early part of the book, the preface, the foreword, I saw that there were some interesting measurements in the original recipes, and I liked butter the size of a hen's egg.
And butter the size of a walnut for comparison. But yeah, there were lots of measurements that were based on implements that they would have had, a coffee cup, a teacup, a wine glass, a wine goblet, things like that.
So you converted these measurements, these odd measurements, into modern measurements. How did you determine what worked? Was this all trial and error?
No, we did a lot of research in early Kentucky cookbooks and early American cookbooks in general. And throughout the course of that research, we were able to find those transitions when they were moving from, you know, a dessert spoon of something into a teaspoon or two teaspoons, as that one is. So a lot of research, mostly.
And you tested all these recipes yourself, which I find remarkable. So when you were in the kitchen and you were trying out these recipes, what did you find to be the most unusual or surprising thing?
One of the most surprising things to both Andrew and I was that with the desserts, they tended to not be as sweet as, you know, cakes or pies that you would find in a bakery today, which I was pleasantly surprised by. I don't like that really heavily sugared kind of dessert. But another thing that surprised both of us was how prevalent the use of oysters were and things like that. And in our research, we found that, you know, oysters were being canned during this time. And by 1856, they were available as far west as St. Louis. So in the time period that we were looking at with these recipes, it was a very natural thing to find.
Well, you just said that the sweets were not as sweet back then. And fortunately, you have brought a sample here, so I can actually verify this. So now, you said this was a sugar pie.
It is.
So I'd expect that to be sweet.
I don't find it too sweet. I had some for breakfast, I have to say.
Let's
see. This
here
is the Seton family sugar pie. Mm. The recipe is around the 1880s.
Oh, that's delicious. But you're right. It's not what I would expect of something that you call a sugar pie.
Right.
So what are some of the ingredients? It looks kind of like a mincemeat pie, but it doesn't taste that way.
No, it's a really simple recipe. It's brown sugar and water that you boil for just a little bit, and then you add tempered eggs, two eggs, some melted butter and flour, and a little salt.
I think that's one of the things that impressed me, too, about this book is how simple the recipes are. Things like eggs and water, and you make this magnificent, almost a souffle out of them.
And that was surprising. And one of the things that we've told a lot of people, because sometimes you'll hear someone say that older recipes don't have a lot of flavor, which I would definitely disagree with. And
certainly,
one of the reasons
yeah
that I think that these do have flavor is that these people were using fresh ingredients, you know, very fresh milk and eggs, and using local fruits and vegetables or canned fruits and vegetables that they had. And that's what we tried to do, too, when we were making these recipes.
Now, most of the recipes I saw in the book have a name associated with them. So who are some of the people whose recipes you put into the book?
Well, that's how we identified them, by the collection that they were located in, because in many cases when when they were putting together their books of collected recipes, they might be attributed to someone else. And so for consistency's sake, we did it based on the archival collection. But you'll find recipes from the Clay family, the Breckenridge families, Preston Johnson.
The Clay family as in Henry Clay?
As in Henry Clay. And not him, but that would be Annie Clay McDowell. And so she had an amazing collection, a journal of all handwritten recipes. And we had a lot of standards that we felt like had to be put into the cookbook, things like pound cake and mayonnaise and fried chicken, burgoo, some classic Kentucky dishes or Southern dishes, and we found many of those recipes in hers. She was Henry Clay's granddaughter.
And the fried chicken is another example of how simple these recipes are. There's no secret herbs and spices. It's basically flour, and it's how you cook it, really, more than the spicing.
Yeah, for that one, I used my grandmother's cast iron skillet, so I think that helped.
It makes a big difference. Well, in preparing this cookbook, what did you learn about the lives of the people who created or collected these recipes?
Well, I thought a lot about that at the time. You know, these handwritten recipes I looked at as being manuscripts, unpublished manuscripts, which was another, I think, interesting aspect of this project. For some, with the research that I did, for instance, there's a cookbook attributed to Mary and Peter, and it's dated the year that she got married. And so based on that connection, I think she was probably compiling that recipe book as she went to start, you know, her own family and her own home. Frances Jewell McVeigh, she had an amazing amount of handwritten recipes, and she was known. She was referred to as the First Lady of Maxwell Place. She was Dean of Women at the University of Kentucky, and then she went on to marry University President Frank McVeigh. But she was known for her hostessing. And for her recipes, they were often for really large groups. And so you could tell that she was entertaining. But she has a quote that I love. It was sort of an inspiration through the process that was published in an article that she wrote called Traditional Dishes for Old Kentucky Guests that was published in the New York Times on September 5th, 1937. And she said, "Dining in Kentucky is an art, and as an artistic expression, it has been created by, and in turn, it creates the vivacity, ardor, frankness, generosity, yea, even courage of the people of the Bluegrass State." So she was an incredible lady for sure.
Well, thank you. That's marvelous. And thank you also for the sugar pie.
You're welcome.
I wish I could share it with everyone. Our guest has been Deirdre Skaggs, who is co-author of The Historic Kentucky Kitchen, brand new from University Press of Kentucky. Our complete UK Perspectives interview with some photographs is available at wuky.org. For WUKY, I'm Tom Goodell.